The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following program was pre-recorded, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station or its management.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Get ready to take notes, because school is now in session. Tackling the biggest issues in education, this is Education America. Save the classroom, save the country. Here are your hosts, Headmaster Rebecca Hagstrom and co-host Abigail Johnson.
Hey, teacher, leave them kids alone.
Welcome to Education America, where we are working to save the classroom so that we can save the country. K-12 education is the playing field where the battle is on for the future of our country. And as the 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, succinctly stated, the philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of government in the next. Welcome, Abigail, and you can introduce our wonderful guest who's coming back.
Speaking of battling for education, we have one of the expert warriors in that battle with us again today, Mr. Daniel Sir. Daniel is an attorney who has litigated cases across the country on behalf of parents, schools, and elected officials. He is working to advance educational freedom and school choice. He is a senior legal fellow at National Opportunity Project and is the president of the Center for American Rights. Daniel, thank you for joining us again tonight.
Hey, ladies. Great to be back on the program.
All right. Well, that's wonderful. Well, last week, we spent a lot of time discussing your National Opportunity Project survey of school districts that really did a deep dive into how diversity, equity, and inclusion is influencing the hiring practices of not only the colleges, which we've now found is illegal based on the Supreme Court case, but also is infiltrating K-12 hiring practices. And for those listeners who are joining us tonight, we'd encourage you to go back and listen to that episode from last week. But this week, we want to really take the other portion of your expertise, which is the legal side. You are also president of the Center for American Rights, as Abigail said. And so that's more of the battling portion, as you pointed out. And so we want to spend time talking tonight about the legal landscape for school choice, which has in recent years been improving. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're seeing nationwide, what some of the big battles are, and maybe talk also about the case from Montana regarding the Blaine Amendment, too, because I think a lot of listeners might have some misunderstanding of the rules around school choice, especially as it relates to religious schools.
Yeah, great question. And the good news is we have made so much progress in the past 20 years to put school choice on a firm legal foundation to the point today where I think it is solidly established in federal law that school choice is constitutional. The reality is obviously school choice involves faith-based schools, that many, not all, but many of the schools that participate in choice are faith-based. And so there was a question early on, how do we reconcile providing payments, tuition payments to faith-based schools with the First Amendment, right? Our U.S. Constitution says that we can't have an established religion. Part of that is that we don't, you know, pay taxes that subsidize churches like you might find in England. How do we reconcile these two principles? And the Supreme Court said pretty clearly early on in a case called Zelman versus Harris about the Cleveland school choice program that the key is the money goes to the parents and the student, before it goes to the school.
Right.
So it's not like the government is giving our money to a faith-based organization. The government's not giving our money to a church. Mm-hmm. The government's giving money to parents, and parents are using that money and making an independent choice to support a school. So that was a great win 20 years ago, and school choice has blossomed nationwide afterwards. Mm-hmm. But just 2 years ago, the Supreme Court decided a follow-up case that asked the question sort of in reverse. The state of Montana had a tax credit scholarship program, and Montana said, in order to comply with the First Amendment, we are going to, and Montana's, to comply with Montana's sort of broader version of the First Amendment, which is called the Blaine Amendment, and I'll explain what Blaine Amendments are in a second. Montana said, we're going to exclude faith-based schools. In fact, we have to exclude faith-based schools from this tax credit scholarship program. And in Espinoza versus Montana, the Supreme Court said, no, another key principle of the First Amendment is that you cannot discriminate against religious organizations based simply on the fact that they're faith-based. You can't, as government, exclude or discriminate against people of faith in the way you operate programs. You have to follow a principle of neutrality. And so that has really opened the door to say that all schools, all faith-based, church-based schools have the same right as any other school to participate in these school choice programs. And it really opens up the field for states to adopt these sorts of programs and to just get more students in seats outside of public schools.
Which is so wonderful to know that this is expanding. And I, you know, I don't want to get too far in the weeds with the Blaine Amendments, but there are Blaine Amendments in nearly every state. And I'm just curious how you would recommend to families kind of how to deal with that in a state where school choice hasn't expanded yet. And we can still talk about where it has, but where it hasn't yet expanded and those Blaine Amendments are still in place, what can parents do to try to set the tone for their own state? Obviously, it would have to be a grassroots effort, but how would you recommend parents address that?
Yeah, great question. So Blaine Amendments are named for James G. Blaine from Maine, who was a U.S. Congressman back about more than a century ago now. And unfortunately, it was a time in the United States of intense anti-Catholic prejudice. That we were seeing boatloads of immigrants from places like Ireland and Italy and Sicily and Poland. And there was this harsh nativist reaction, an anti-Catholic reaction. And one manifestation of that anti-Catholic prejudice was to say, we don't want Catholic kids in Catholic schools. We need to take these new immigrants and force them into public schools. We're going to teach them American values. And remember, back in the day, public schools were basically Protestant schools. They had Bible reading, they had daily prayer, et cetera. So we need to force these Catholic kids into our Protestant public schools. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to adopt these state constitutional amendments that bar public funds from going to faith-based or sectarian schools. And so it's a really ugly history.
Yes, it is.
That's still living with us today. Because today, Catholic schools and other faith-based schools are still barred in many states from accessing these funds. Now, the good news is, after Espinoza versus Montana, the Supreme Court case that I've talked about, many of these Blaine Amendments are just flatly unconstitutional. Right? If it says no government money for faith-based schools, that's discrimination, and it's just wrong and it's unconstitutional. The problem is, in about a dozen states, it says no government money for private schools, which is different than faith-based schools. It covers faith-based schools, but it also covers, you know, a secular Montessori program, for instance. And so in those states, really, I think we have two options. One is legislation and the other is litigation. So on litigation, it's to sue and say, even though this doesn't discriminate on its face against people of faith, that was its purpose. It was written And its historical record is clear that its goal was to discriminate against people of faith, and it's still having that effect today. And that's sort of a historical question that you just got to fight it out in court.
Mm-hmm.
The other option, I think, for legislation is to use tax credit scholarship programs, which is one tool that states have in the sort of overall school choice toolbox, where you give a tax credit to a company or taxpayer that makes a donation, a charitable donation, to a scholarship organization, and that scholarship organization then provides a scholarship to students to attend a private or faith-based school, so it sort of breaks the connection.
Right.
I think similarly, you know, like ESAs, education savings accounts, where parents have broad flexibility to use it for tuition or homeschool materials or tutors, right? It helps break that connection between the government funds and the private faith-based schools. So they're definitely both legislative and litigation tools to get around these remaining Blaine Amendments. But it's sad that our country is still saddled with the legacy of anti-Catholic prejudice that still today is limiting choices for kids.
Yeah, it's really shocking. I remember when I first learned of Blaine Amendments, I was shocked to know that that's the history, and yet they were still being used today to try to keep, you know, faith-based schools from receiving any money.
I mean, let's name the real sadness here.
Right.
That teachers' unions and opponents of school choice are so cynical that they will take something as awful and evil as anti-Catholic prejudice and twist it to their own ends today to kill policy that they don't like. Like that is just incredibly cynical on their part to take these amendments that, that we all recognize have this terrible prejudice past and nevertheless use it to try to kill school choice for kids. That's what's so sad to me.
Yes, it is. Well, let's turn the tables to something more positive and talk about some of the states. Well, you, by the way, worked under Governor Walker in Wisconsin when, and you were instrumental in expanding their school choice effort there in Wisconsin a number of years ago. And then we're seeing a lot of change across the country where we're seeing expansion and introduction of school choice. So talk about some of the positives that have happened.
Yeah, let's not focus in on all the stuff that's happening in Minnesota. It can be kind of depressing.
Right. No, I wish I could say I could see this happening in Minnesota, but my goodness sakes, every time it's brought up,
it's a ways off. We'll just say that.
It gets smashed down. But anyway, but yes, let's talk about where it is working.
It is working across the country. And parents are rising up after the pandemic. There has been such incredible parent outrage after parents saw through their own eyes, through the screens that they were watching with their kids, saw what's happening in public schools. There's just been tremendous demand across the country for access to alternatives. And so we've seen a number of states, Arkansas, Iowa, Oklahoma, Arizona, Florida, go down the list. The battle right now is in Texas, where we are seeing more and more states adopting school choice programs. And part of what's so exciting about it is that, you know, many of these, Arizona and Oklahoma are great examples, are universal school choice programs.
Wow.
Now, when we thought about school choice in the past, it was really a tool for inner city kids to get out of bad inner city public schools. And so they were really tailored to help low income families that couldn't afford private school tuition otherwise to escape bad public schools in places like Milwaukee or Cleveland. That's how the school choice program started. And what we're seeing today is that parents across the board, regardless whether you're in an urban or rural or suburban school district, parents at every type of school, at every income level, are demanding educational options. And states are responding with these big, universal school choice programs that give parents in all sorts of school districts, regardless of their income, the opportunity to go somewhere else and really to move to a system where we fund students instead of buildings, where we fund kids instead of districts. That's the goal. That's what we should be moving towards. And we're making major progress in states towards that.
You sound like Corey DeAngelis when you say, fund students, not systems.
He's a great American.
Yeah, yes. We've had him on our show. But, you know, I'm also curious, are a lot of these states going with education savings accounts, or, you know, what is there one format that seems to be working better than another, or is it really just individualistic to each state?
Great question. The state of Arizona has really been on the forefront of education savings accounts, ESAs, as we call them in the business. And what's great about ESAs, I think, is that it gives parents so much flexibility that it's not just, here's a voucher, go to a private school, use it to pay tuition, right? But ESAs allow parents to say, I want a tutor for my kid, and I want that tutor to be, you know, someone who can teach them music, right? A piano teacher. Or I want a tutor from a local college who can help them do advanced algebra, right? It helps not just families that want to use traditional school models, but families that want to use non-traditional school models. So if you want to be in a micro school setting, if you want to be in an online, over the internet educational content, if you want to homeschool and use the money toward curriculum, ESAs have all of that flexibility built in, and I think allow parents a lot more options. And then even within those families that choose to go to a private school, it gives parents, I think, leverage or an incentive with that private school to drive a good deal on tuition, because any money that they save, anything that they spend out of their ESA less than the cap, they can either put into supplementary services or they can eventually roll over towards college. Right? So it's not creating a system like you might have in like a voucher where if the voucher is $7,500, every private school is going to charge $7,500.
Right.
Right? If you have an ESA, maybe as a parent, you're like, you know what? I think that this school should, you know, for K-5 should only cost $6,500. And then if you can save that $1,000, you can pay for supplementary services or you can save it towards college. So I love ESAs. I think they're a great tool.
Yeah. That sounds like a very good tool. And it also sounds like it avoids maybe some of the problems that were associated with those Blaine amendments where you said they just are against all private schools, not just faith-based schools too, right? So that would help get around that.
Yeah, ESAs are great because they give maximum control to parents. And in doing so, they break the transition of money from the government to a faith-based school in the most clean and clear way, such that I think the legal argument against them is the hardest.
Right.
So both from a policy perspective and a legal perspective, ESAs have a lot of advantages.
That's great. You mentioned in conversation earlier that micro schools are something that you're kind of passionate about, and Abigail and I are part of a private school called Liberty Classical Academy, and we're part of we're in the Twin Cities here. But you mentioned that there are some regulations that are kind of stopping some of these micro schools. So maybe we can give you a chance to talk about that briefly here.
Yeah, so many parents are demanding different options, including different ideas of what school can look like. You guys at the Classical Academy are a great example of that, right? We're just going to take a totally different approach to curriculum. While other parents are demanding different approaches to things like class size, right? They're saying, I want my child to be in a setting of maybe 8 to 10 students or 10 to 12 students that are from different grades, and I'm okay with that, right? It's going to be more of a Montessori-style education. Parents are saying, I'm not wedded to 5 days a week, right? Nowhere in Holy Scripture is it written that school must be from 8 to 4. Monday through Friday, right? And so some parents want more than just a once-a-month homeschool co-op meeting for a few hours on, you know, the first Friday of the month, but they don't want to go 5 days a week, right? They want 3 days a week, or they want just in the morning but not the afternoon. In the afternoon, they'll homeschool. And so we've seen more and more of these unique, innovative educational models developing, coming out of the pandemic, but even before the pandemic. And our regulatory structures just aren't ready for it. Our government licensing, our laws, our education agencies, they just have these clear lines and these buckets that they want to put people in. Oh, you're a private school. Oh, you're a daycare. Oh, you're a public school. And so these innovative, non-traditional models that don't fit cleanly into one of these buckets, the government just doesn't know what to do with. But it's convinced it has to regulate them somehow.
Of course.
Right? Because heaven forbid, right, parents just be free with their kids. Right? You've got to regulate it somehow.
Exactly.
And so this is a real challenge, frankly. And so working with our partners at the National Microschooling Center and the Herzog Foundation, we've been reaching more and more startup school leaders and parents and pods to say, we will defend you. We will provide legal advocacy for you. We will help you navigate this difficult and complicated regulatory environment so that you can do what you want to do, which is best for kids. Mm-hmm. And that's just part of our mission at National Microschooling Center, Center for American Rights, is to help these education innovators.
Mm. Well, innovation, that's what historically made America what it is now. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, it's so encouraging to see what is happening in education, that more and more parents are waking up. And I know, Daniel, you've said a few different times, parents are demanding, you know, a different way. They're demanding a higher standard for their students. And I just think that that's incredible. And I hope that more and more parents hear there are such a wide variety of options. Mm-hmm. We absolutely understand that public school is a great fit for some kids, possibly. In some situations, sometimes private school is going to be the best fit. And for some families, it is going to be a micro school. It is going to be homeschool. No one school is going to fit the needs of every single family, which is what really has led to the downfall of public education. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because they tried to meet really well. We won't go into that. But
it's a monopoly.
Yeah, but they tried. But they did. Yeah. You saw 50 mm-hmm. years ago, they were trying. They were trying to take the role of the family and the teacher and the meal provider, and trying to make everyone fit into a box. Mm-hmm. And I just love that there are people and organizations like yours that are supporting parents who are saying, my child doesn't fit into a box, and that's okay. And we're going to be creative, and we're going to be innovative, and we are not just going to be consumers, but we are going to build something. Mm-hmm. And I mean, what an amazing gift, you know, that your legal expertise can be for families like that.
It's so encouraging, and I'm so hopeful for the future that we are moving toward this dynamic, open-ended education marketplace where kids are not being put into assembly line-style classrooms, where Thomas Dewey is dead, and we can move into a future that gives kids options, that gives families customization, that meets students where they're at. We're not there yet.
No.
We're a long way from there yet. Mm-hmm. But the vision is out there. That future is possible. But you're right. Parents have to demand it. We have to be not just consumers, but citizens. We have to expect that our legislators provide us the tools we need in order to afford these things. We need laws that are pro-innovation, that are less about permission and regulation and more about encouragement and innovation. But when we do that, when we get there, it's going to be great for our kids and it's going to be great for our country.
Mm-hmm. So a question that I'll ask, because I live in the state of Minnesota, is what do you say to those individuals, especially teachers' unions, and I think we should talk about that in a moment, who say you're just going to kill the public schools?
It's just not true. It's demonstrably not true. We've seen school choice come in many states, and public schools continue to do just fine. Many states, the way they fund these education innovations is through additional dollars. So it's not like we're taking money away from the public schools. Mm-hmm. For instance, in Wisconsin, you know, we're often injecting new tax dollars into education to provide these alternative options for students. But ultimately, I believe public schools benefit from school choice because it creates competitive market pressure.
Exactly.
Right? When public schools mm-hmm. don't have to compete, when they have a monopoly, mm-hmm. They don't have to do their best.
Mm-hmm.
But we know from every other segment of American society, when we have multiple competitors in a market, one thing for teachers, it means higher pay, hopefully, right? It means mm-hmm. more options for teachers to find the kind of school, not just that that's going to pay them better, but where they feel like they fit the most, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's not just students who are looking for customization and options. It should equally be the teachers mm-hmm. who are saying, I want a different type of educational experience that I want to deliver. I want a curriculum that reflects my values. I want to be able to teach only in the mornings, but have off in the afternoon, right? Like, we should have a marketplace that serves not just students, but also teachers. And we can get that when we create more options and more opportunities. And I think it will actually drive innovation, not just in the market overall, but also innovation and improvement within our public schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that is really the number one thing. I can't really think of another industry in America that absolutely has that kind of a monopoly without it being broken up by the Department of Labor or whatever. And yet,
Google.
You know, yeah.
I can think of one.
Yes. Okay. And Amazon. Mm-mm. Okay. No, I'm just saying, but they're all on the table, and, you know, there's a lot of conversation about that, and there's reasons why not. But we've come to accept public education, and there was such good reason for it in the beginning. But when we see where things have gone, when it's no longer serving the needs of the people, you really have to take a step back and say, is this the best we can do? Mm-hmm. And so I just really applaud you, Daniel, and your team for standing up for students and parents and even teachers. We only have about 30 seconds here, but I know that you're representing teachers who are also trying to leave teachers' unions. And that's a whole different topic that we could spend another show on. But do you have any last comments, you know, just here in the last 20 seconds or so that you'd like to share with our listeners, Daniel?
I think it's important for all of us as parents to look out for what's best for our kids. And we have such an opportunity right now. It's happening. And if it's not happening yet in your state, parents really do need to continue to advocate, step up, ask for it, demand it, and just do it. Mm-hmm. You can exit the public schools. You can create a micro school. You can create a home school. You can send your kids to a great place like Liberty Classical Academy. The option is yours. It's worth taking the plunge and just doing it.
All right. On that note, yes. Well said. Thank you so much for joining us today, Daniel. And thank you to our listeners for listening. And again, you can find Daniel at National Opportunity Project. And listen to our podcast at Spotify and iTunes. Have a good night.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.